I am 29, the 29th of April 1982 to the 28th of April 1983. Over. Saturn Can Do One by Ali Flind. When I'm grown to man's estate, I shall be very proud and great, and tell the other girls and boys not to meddle with my toys. Of course, by Robert Louis Stevenson. I spent the evening of the first day of my 29th year lurking at the back of an Echo and the Bunnymen gig in Dunfermline, contemplating how to stop the march of time. It wasn't my age or mortality that troubled me. It was the concept of adulthood itself. Despite the responsibility I had with Zoo Records and managing Echo and the Bunnymen and the Teardrop Explodes, I wasn't sure that I ever wanted to feel grown up. I didn't really give a shite whether other people thought I was mature or not. But I did not want to feel as if I was becoming predictable or sensible or any of the other things that I believed might curb my compulsions. I couldn't explain what motivated me at that point. Still can't really. But I was pretty sure that maturity, or my perception of it, were the antithesis of it. What brought on this intense bout of introspection? A couple of weeks earlier, I'd come home to my wife at our home in Crawford Avenue, just off Penny Lane in Liverpool, to find her sitting at the kitchen table drinking tea with an old friend, Linda. My wife had clearly told her my birthday was approaching as Linda greeted me strangely. "All ready for your first Saturn returning then?" "What the fuck is that?" I asked. "Every 29 and a half years or so, Saturn orbits the Sun. When it returns to where it was at the time of your birth, you enter the next stage of your life." That was Linda explaining. "The first Saturn return is when you leave youth behind and enter adulthood. On the second return, you reach full maturity. And with the third, and usually final return, you arrive at wise old age." "But I became an adult at 18, and have always been wise," I quipped, attempting to laugh off all this bollocks. But for some reason, the concept perturbed me. At the same time, I was troubled that it bothered me so much. I did not believe in astrology. Apparently, I'm the same star sign as Hitler. But for some reason, the idea of being dragged into adulthood, even at the ripe old age of 29, alarmed me. And as the band launched into No Dark Things, I mulled my existential predicament. So many strange synchronicities had occurred since I began working with Echo and the Bunnymen. It was as if I, or some sort of collective consciousness, had willed things into existence, and I had become wary of the waywardness of my imagination. I'd inadvertently created my own personal mythology, which then developed a life of its own. Simply refusing to believe in Saturn's return might not work either. Sometimes, when you focus really hard on not thinking about something, you find it is all you can think about. Like, if I tell you not to think about Margaret Thatcher naked, she will instantly pop into your head. Scissors! I'd seen firsthand the effects of constantly reinforcing a thought. Someone plants a notion in your brain and it all remains there, becoming ego-encrusted self-talk. If Mac and Copy are both geniuses, then I blame their mothers. It was clear to me from observing them both that all you really needed to be a great frontman is to have grown up with a mother who tells you from the very first moment you can remember how wonderful you are. This is the reason those two had the balls to get up on stage in front of an audience, knowing they could only play one chord and sing out of tune, whilst believing that they were fucking magical. Instead of procrastinating and waiting until they were good, they started first and learned their craft as they went. Although I'm not sure this is necessarily a bad thing. Mac pretty much left school and then stayed in bed until he achieved stardom. His mother gave him the conviction he needed to will it into existence. When he boldly announced that he wanted to replace Frank Sinatra as the greatest crooner of all time, I was forced to bite my tongue while simultaneously admiring his complete lack of humility or self-awareness. But without this kind of confidence, we'd never have experienced Elvis. Much of what I do has been described as ritual or even magical, and I will embrace these things when it suits me to do so, or when it suits me to pretend to do so, in order to engage or exacerbate others. As I planned the Bunnymen's 1983 tour later that year, I told the press that it was plotted along ley lines, starting in Iceland and passing through Matthew Street, Liverpool, where Jung himself had envisaged the Pool of Life. Consciously or subconsciously, I hoped that my actions would simultaneously ward off the effects of Saturn's return, whilst playfully rebutting the band's ego-driven bullshit. Would Sinatra have performed along the old straight track? Of course, the stuff about ley lines was rubbish. But these things tend to take on a life of their own. Legend now has it that the tour was plotted in a giant pair of bunny ears. I won't bother to clarify the facts, but perhaps you'd like to plot the dates on the map yourself and see what I really drew. Postscript. When you're a kid, you tend to believe your parents know what they're doing. When you have kids yourself, you realise your parents were probably just winging it. For the most part, that is. Perhaps none of us really become adults or wise old men. We're just pretending we are when it serves us to do so. My mum thought I was rubbish at everything. I will always be grateful to her for that.
Under, Baking in the Oven, by Daniel Bushell. I have no idea whether this falls into this year, or 10 earlier, or even 10 years later. I have no idea if this was my experience, or someone I knew, or something I read. I don't even like it. It feels like a half-formed, poorly constructed thought dragged out of me for some forgotten deadline. But it is here to represent some facsimile of this time, and the ink drum is running out of static. I breathe in and hear the birdsong from outside, or the radio, or the television, or in my head, or from the record player. I didn't witness any change in my body from the breath going in. I wait and focus on the birdsong. When I'm done with that, I breathe out and follow the breath all the way out, uninterrupted. I breathe in, noting the stomach rising gently, but the tick of the timer spins into the audio field, click, 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 or is it tick, tick, tick? hold my breath and breathe out, focus on the mechanical sound until it subsides and I refocus. I breathe in and witness the air rushing through my nose and cooling my nostrils ever so slightly but noticeably, and I sense my chest expand. I breathe out and can't pick up a change on my nose, but now I have an itch. I have the start of an itch on my cheek, tingling, buzzing, the electricity in the nerves firing. I rub my cheek and proceed. The breath goes in, I can still feel a residue of sensation of rubbing my cheek, and the fingers on my hand hold my attention. I hold the breath and push out, focusing the breath puffing out of my nose. The breath goes in, tune into the smell of the ashtray on the table and a background of coal from the fire. I can tune into the sound of the fire crackling and hold the smells, the sense of a full breath, all three at once. I hold that until I am ready to breathe out and refocus. The breath goes in, the chest widens a little, hold. The breath goes out and the chest returns to normal. Why did I call the latter normal? Why isn't breathing in normal? Why did I focus on that? Why did my attention move to my chest from my stomach? Refocus. The breath goes in. The stomach rises and expands, pushing out. There is a pause. The breath goes out. The stomach settles and flattens. Again, what is the normal state? One is at rest, but only as a counterpoint to the expansion? Refocus. I breathe in, I feel the air travel down, it takes too long, I'm out of rhythm with something, I wait. I push the air out, it moves out too quickly, too slowly. What am I judging against? I refocus. The breath goes in, I feel nothing, I wait, I push the breath out, nothing. Is that the right place to be? Refocus. I notice the breath going and the held breath goes out. I am getting it now, but noticing that means I am not getting it. What a paradox. Focus. The breath goes in, hold the breath, goes out, hold, another breath in, hold, another breath out, hold, everything clears, and just as I have this nailed, my subconscious kicks. At some stage this year, my work took me through the town of my youth. Looking at the sights so richly and vividly remembered and retold in previous chapters, I cannot now recollect this return visit. The factories, schools, stations, churches, synagogues, temples and shops all blur into a vague mass of brick and cement. Even the glass is sand. All of this stuff built for purpose, from all sorts of minerals and chemicals dragged out of the ground, by machines built from elements dragged out of the ground and transformed by other matter dragged out of the ground. The bell rings on the timer. My attention goes straight to my breath. That's all it wants to focus on now. The time is up. The sounds and smells and itches are no longer evident. This loop of manufacture leading to a full stop of culture, a spudge you like. Breathe in, take the sand, breathe out, make concrete. Breathe in, mould the block, breathe out, stack on the others. Breathe in, sow the potatoes, breathe out, reap the spuds. Breathe in, catch the bus from Corby, breathe out, serve the spud to someone after the pub. Turning the realisation of all that attribution into my existence, I could see the same themes. The same with art. Cave paintings begat friezes, begat portraits, then Renaissance, and then modernism, postmodernism, into AI and beyond. The same with literature. Symbols and tallies leading to names and slogans and reading out loud to reading within to printing presses of Bibles and manifestos to magazines to advertising to 140-character encapsulation. The same of music. Animal cries to mystic chanting to percussion and onto the harmonic scale to woodwind, brass and onto electrification to the keyboard. Then it changes, then the sample, which drags everything else back into the same place. All of this stuff picked up, transformed and dropped and pushed and pulled into some form or shape. Building on what came before. Where does this end? What do I want from it? What is my calling? Is there a calling? Are there wants and needs? The subconscious subsides. The fire, the crackle, the burnt wood smell approaches, or do I approach it? The chair feels a little numb on my behind, and the weak winter sunshine cracks through the gap in the curtains. I had the foresight to put dinner in the oven, and it smells like it is ready. What is that baking in the oven?
A Troubled Dream. The Bunny by Simon Fellowes. The bunny. Not the Donnie Darko bunny, but a benign bunny. A big, bouncing, curvaceous bunny. The Cadbury's caramel bunny. Maybe not that curvaceous, but benign. Kindly. With my best interests at heart. And female, definitely a female bunny. So, a doe then. A doe bunny. Sitting on my bed. At the end of my bed, staring at me in pity, in disappointment, in resignation. I wake up, as one would do, and stare at the bunny, wondering what the hell she is doing at the end of my bed. The bunny speaks to me. This doesn't come as a surprise. I figure I must be dreaming, and in dreams, bunnies speak. Bill, I need you to come with me. I want to show you something. I blink. I'm feeling pretty warm under the bedclothes. I don't want to go anywhere. But something in the bunny's voice makes it clear I have no choice in the matter. Wherever she wants to take me, that's where I'm going to go. And within seconds, that's what happens. I am flying out of the bedroom window, the bunny alongside me. We're over the city. Everything is dark. The sky, the darkest purple. Way darker than Prince Purple. Darker even than Cadbury's Purple. It's a purple that's almost black. The kind of purple you see on royal robes. You think it's black, but in fact, it's purple. The darkest purple you've ever seen. Blood purple. Below me, the skyscrapers of the city twinkle, their warning lights like hot pokers reaching into the sky. Orange tungsten swarms across the landscape, bathing everything in a desert glow. I feel the cold air against my skin. I'm wearing pyjamas, striped pyjamas. The same as my father used to wear. A white toweling cord keeps the bottoms up. My feet are feeling chilly. I look down at them. My skin is so white. It's the skin of an old man. The skin of an old man dying. The skin of an old man with not much time left. I try to snuggle up to the bunny for warmth, but she won't let me. She keeps me at a paw's distance, as if to make it clear I don't deserve her. That I can't depend on her for love. Where are you taking me? I ask. You'll find out soon enough, says the bunny, her eyes fixed on the horizon. We leave the city behind and head north. We are racing. The coast below is a blur. I try to make out how far we have travelled, but find it impossible. We're headed towards East Anglia, past the villages where my family once lived. Within seconds, we're over Hull, then Scarborough, Sunderland. Time has collapsed. We are moving at a supernatural speed. Finally, we start to slow. Are we in Scotland? I look down, but can see no landmarks. The gouge of the Clyde seems to have passed us by. Where are we now? Kirkcaldy? Dundee? It doesn't matter. I'm not in control. No longer in control of the map, the journey, I'm powerless at the mercy of the bunny. I feel a jolt to my right. We're heading inland, pulled by the Highlands. I feel my heart leap. I realise where the bunny has taken me. I should have known all along. There is only one spot my destiny lies. Always has been. Always has been. The phrase sticks in my throat. Is that all I'll be known for? When the testimony is written, and is that all that'll be left? Is that what the bunny is trying to tell me? All my struggles to define myself, all my travels, all my energies, all my generosities, reduced to one night huddled over a fire. So be it. Let it be. I've processed it, as they say. There's nothing the bunny can do or say to rub my nose further in the dirt to upset me. I've heard it all, dealt with it 1,000 times. There's nothing more to be said, nothing to make me feel more stupid or guilty. We start to slow down. We're coming into land. I stare into the darkness, try to pick out anything familiar. The curve of the Lissa, the humps of the Paps. But all I can see is a large white building. What's it doing here? Is it a new addition? It doesn't look old. It looks austere, like a sanatorium, a place where people go to grow old. Seconds later, we're inside the building. The bunny is leading me down a series of corridors. All I can hear is weeping and moaning, the sound of children's voices begging, pleading. Along each corridor are hundreds of doors. They go on forever, all of them closed. At the end of the hall, the bunny tells me to stop. She turns me around. The wailing from the rooms grows louder. All the doors open. Stepping out of the rooms are children of all ages, boys, girls, babies carried in nurses' arms. They walk towards me, calling my name. Daddy, Daddy. There must be hundreds of them, all of them looking exactly like me. I feel choked, overwhelmed. I find it hard to breathe. I break out in sweat, my pyjamas drenched. I start shaking my head, wanting the apparition to disappear. I close my eyes, reach out my hands to push the children away from me. I wake up to find myself back in bed. The bunny is on top of me. It's impossible to breathe. I try to cry out, but my voice is muffled. No one can hear me. I'm drowning. I'm drowning.